Americans tend to be known around the world for our positive thinking.
We are the place, after all, where Oprah gained millions of viewers with her encouragement to be your best self, and book stars are filled with self-help advice.
Even political messages like, yes, we can, enforce the idea that anything we put our minds to is possible.
But how do we get to be a nation of positive thinkers? Mitch Horowitz tries to answer that question in his new book. It's called One Simple Idea: How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. Mitch, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
How important do you think positive thinking is to American culture today?
It's really central to American culture. If it wasn't for the positive thinking movement, however we come down on it, we wouldn't feel like ourselves. You know, some of the best-known expressions in American life derive from positive thinking, whether it's yes, we can, or just do it, be all you can be, nothing is impossible. We talk in these terms, and without the positive thinking movement, our culture would look and sound very different.
Where did that come from in our history?
It really started in the mid-19th century in New England with a movement called the Mental Healing Movement, or the Mind Cure Movement. American medicine was in terrible condition for much of the 19th century. In fact, our medicine lagged behind the medical sciences in Europe. It was probably the one consistent area where development in the U.S. lagged behind Europe. And people were desperate for alternatives, so they began to look to prayer therapy and autosuggestion and what would later come to be known as hypnotism, and try to find ways of healing themselves. And many thousands of people decided that it worked and sought to use the mind as an agency to improve other areas of life, like career and finance and relationships.
And where does it go from there in terms of, you know, the medical claims? In general, you know, Americans, we are positive. Sometimes we're skeptical a lot, and we like there to be proof. Is there proof in the pudding that positive thinking works?
Well, most of the proof from that time was testimonial and anecdotal. It was interesting. You know, there were people who reported chores by using mental cure methods, and there were people who were struck by terrible tragedy by not seeking out standard medical care. It's just that standard medical care at the time was so poor, it was difficult proving whether it would have done any good, you know, had it been sought out, rather than using Christian Science methods, which was a religion that came out of the mental healing movement, or other forms of what was then known as mind cure. By the late 19th century, particularly with the opening of Johns Hopkins University Medical School, medicine got a lot better in this country, and by the 1890s, people weren't as desperate. There wasn't the same need to seek out alternative cures, although there were lots of them. Homeopathy, botanical remedies, and other things grew out of that era. But the country was changing, and the economy was really growing, and people were very eager and anxious to join the growing economy. And some of the people in the mental healing movement at that time, late 1880s, early 1890s, began to pioneer what later became known as the prosperity gospel, in which you would think and grow rich, as the expression goes.
Moving ahead a little bit, when I hear the phrase positive thinking, I think of The Power of Positive Thinking by Reverend Norman Vincent Peale. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, I wasn't around when it came out, but this is a book that was all over the place in, what was it, the early 50s, 1950s?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You really can't exaggerate that book's impact. When that book came out in 1952, it became the best-selling book that had ever been published in America, with the exception of the Bible. I mean, it was a book that you would just find in every household. It's still quite popular today. And the author, Norman Vincent Peale, was a Methodist minister who grew up in Ohio. And during the Great Depression, he was placed in charge of a congregation on Manhattan's east side, a Dutch Reformed congregation. And Peale was politically and culturally a very conservative guy, but religiously, he was a great experimenter, and he was willing to look into all kinds of different methods, many of which had to do with positive thinking metaphysics. There were movements that ranged from Christian Science to New Thought, which was really the movement that the mental cure had morphed into. And Peale just experimented and looked everywhere. He was had an early interest in the thought of the psychologist Carl Jung. He was interested in the ideas of William James and the Transcendentalists. And Peale came to feel that the positive thinking thesis, which is that our thoughts are causative, could be supported by statements in Scripture. And so he proceeded to write The Power of Positive Thinking, and he made positive thinking into a household term.
Is there something that smacks of first world privilege about positive thinking at all, that you actually have the time to read these books and devote your time to thinking positively instead of, you know, working hard to earn money and put food on the table?
Yes, and that's a real flaw of the positive thinking movement. I think there has been value in this movement, but it became an American movement because ours for many generations was an expanding country and expanding economy, and even though there were great differences and inequities and imbalances in wealth, we at least could have the ideal that the individual could raise him or herself up. And Americans believed in that, wanted to believe in that. And the fact is, you know, today you will find a positive thinking movement in America that touches every corner of the nation. And obviously, you're not going to find the same thing on other continents or in other nations where there's a great deal of poverty, where people are locked in a daily struggle to survive. To some extent, ours is a movement of geography, and I encourage people in the positive thinking movement to be cognizant of things like that, because positive thinking in America grew up hand in hand, partly because of the circumstances of America as a nation.
You raise some concerns throughout the book with the way the positive thinking movement has evolved, affected people. But by and large, it seems, looking at your book, like you're sympathetic to it. What's the positive side of positive thinking as you see it?
I am sympathetic to it. I criticize it a great deal, but I feel that the critics, while I will walk down the road with them a long way, they don't look closely enough at some of the possibilities that have emerged from this movement. Right now, we're in the midst of some really interesting studies into the placebo effect, something that we've known about for a long, long time, but that I think we are producing some really interesting new data in, and studies that are coming out of Harvard and UCLA and other medical schools. I think that the people in the positive thinking movement, first of all, they had a rough early idea of a genuine connection between our mood and our sense of physical well-being that I think has been borne out in part by placebo studies, by mind-body medicine, by the familiarity with which we talk about stress-related disease today, whether it be hypertension or ulcers or chronic back or neck or shoulder pain. There's a realization that stress and mood plays a genuine role in our lives. And I also think that within cognitive psychology, the recovery groups, support groups, the 12-step approach to addiction recovery, you have principles and ideas from the positive thinking movement. People very rarely refer back to that movement as an antecedent. But the positive thinkers, although they were using a religious language in the 19th century, they were really struggling with a very rough early conception of what later came to be known as the subconscious mind or the unconscious mind. And I think their efforts amounted to something.
I want to talk about what's been a bit of a centerpiece in the world of positive thinking, and that is this movie called The Secret, which became kind of a runaway hit. It had roots, though, that went back far earlier. Can you tell us about that and where it came from?
Sure. One of the most ironic aspects of The Secret is that when it became popular in 2006, 2007, it directed people's attention to some of the old positive thinking classics. And one of the books that the movie repeatedly extolled and that became very popular was a book called The Science of Getting Rich by a man named Wallace D. Wattles, who had been a Methodist minister and a longtime exponent of what was known as the social gospel. What many of the people who rediscovered Wattles' books didn't realize is that he was a socialist through and through. He ran for Congress and for local offices in Indiana on the Socialist Party ticket of Eugene V. Debs. He was an absolute social progressive and radical who believed at the time that some of these avant-garde religious methods, like the metaphysics of the mind, could help smooth out imbalances in wealth. And if you read The Science of Getting Rich carefully and you kind of have a map of what you're looking for, there's unmistakable socialist and Marxist language in it. And when this book was republished in 2007, it went to the number one spot on the Business Week bestseller list, and it was a centerpiece of The Nation. Of The Secret. It is basically a metaphysical expression of some of the ideas that came out of the social gospel, which was a radical Christian movement that translated the ethics of Christ into a conception of an equitable society, a socially just society. And that was an ironic early part of the development of the prosperity gospel. The prosperity gospel today is associated with mega churches and business motivation, but a lot of the early exponents of it actually believed that metaphysics along with social protests could be a way of creating a more equitable society.
Well, that seems weird to me, because a socialist perspective you'd think would be community-oriented, group-oriented,
right.
Collective, where I think of The Secret as an individual. How am I going to make myself rich? I don't know The Secret,
that's
the gist, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, back in the day, in the progressive era, there was an expression of socialism that was kind of more utopian. There was a novel, Looking Backward, by a man named Edward Bellamy, and he saw this world of mass luxury and plenty and leisure, and that was the vision that Wallace Wattles was coming out of. That vision by the 1930s and 40s disappeared from the positive thinking movement, so it translated more into what you do see in our time in The Secret, which is more of a radically individualist vision.
We're talking to Mitch Horowitz. His new book is One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you believe positive thinking works? Have you seen an example of it in your own life or a time maybe that it didn't work for you? And do you think the self-help industry takes advantage of people more than it actually helps them? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can always post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking right now with Mitch Horowitz. He's vice president and editor-in-chief at Penguin Tarcher Imprint. And we're talking about his book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.
And we'd like to hear your thoughts on positive thinking. Are you a believer or a skeptic? Do you have an example of a time when positive thinking helped you, maybe got you through a hard time, or where it didn't work for you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Oh, and if you were around when The Power of Positive Thinking came out, did it change your life or people you knew? 800-642-1234 is the number, or send an email, talk@WPR.org. Well, Mitch, I want to get into the world of Oprah nowadays. She helped promote The Secret, which we were talking about a little bit there. How has Oprah affected how we think about positive thinking and inspirational messages these days?
Well, she brought many metaphysical books into people's living rooms. And in a certain sense, Oprah was almost, someone would have become Oprah. You know, it was an inevitable phenomenon.
Because if Oprah didn't exist, we'd have to invent her.
Exactly. And we would have. I mean, really, every strain of self-help or therapeutic thought in this country intersects with the positive thinking idea, which is that our thoughts, in some measure or another, determine outcome. And Oprah was this enormously articulate person who was able to capture a therapeutic outlook that has really run throughout our country for a long, long time. When Ronald Reagan was first running for president, he would routinely say in his speeches, nothing is impossible. And Americans were able to connect with that because of generations of motivational psychology. Other presidents just didn't sound that way. Dwight Eisenhower didn't sound that way. Richard Nixon didn't sound that way. But after Reagan, every president had to sound that way. So when Obama was giving his State of the Union address in 2011, he uttered the line, "This is a country where anything is possible." And it was a leaf directly out of Reagan. So we all talk that way to a greater or lesser extent. And those of us who think, oh, gee, that's just shallow and superficial, you'll catch yourself every now and then actually using that phraseology. It's just in the groundwater of our country.
What does the brain research have to say about all this? If we hear a message, you know, from Ronald Reagan, anything's impossible, nothing's impossible, are there certain areas of our brain that just light up and get happy?
Well, there has been some interesting brain research at UCLA recently that touches on all this. There's an emerging field called neuroplasticity, in which researchers have found through brain scans that the actual redirection of your thoughts through certain ritualistic patterns can result in a change in the neural pathways, the pathways in which neurons fire in your brain. So, for example, this has implications for treating people who suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorder. Researchers have found that if people can actively and sustainably redirect their thoughts away from certain ritualistic behaviors, eventually, in cases of OCD, that will result in redirected neural pathways in the brain. And this is a promising field. So, you know, we do have some evidence within a certain window of study that shows that our thoughts and our thought patterns do have some biologic implications for the brain.
We've got some callers who want to weigh in on this now. We'll go to Lee first in Barron County. Lee, hi.
Hi. When I first heard you talking and your guest talking, I was like, oh, I've been there. I've done that. I used to belong to a church years ago. This would have been in the 1980s, affiliated with the Unity School of Christianity, they're called.
Sure.
And they're very much part of this turn-of-the-century movement that you were talking about. My understanding is that they were basically an offshoot of Christian Science. And what I always called them, for people who didn't understand, was I would tell them it was Christian Science Light. You were allowed to go to the doctor. it served me well in some ways. What I really liked about it was that a critical mass of their ministers are women.
Mm-hmm.
About 40-45%, which is mm-hmm. was astonishing to me, and that really appealed to me. So I was affiliated with the church for a number of years, but what ended up making me leave it was I was suffering from, at the time, I know this now, but I didn't really understand it then, from clinical depression. And the positive thinking, the as you think, you will become kind of theology, had me in a funk, and it was making the depression worse,
mm-hmm.
actually, that
mm-hmm.
because I wasn't thinking the right thoughts, I wasn't able to heal myself. And as a result, I was staying miserable.
Lee, thanks so much. And is that a common criticism, Mitch, of positive thinking?
Yes, and that's a wonderful observation. And in fact, I start out the first chapter of my book quoting from a letter from a woman who sounds much like the caller, very deeply sensitive, intelligent person, who attended a metaphysical positive thinking church. And she left disillusioned after several years because she was working as a coordinator for a group of women survivors of sexual abuse. And she said she could see both sides of it. She could see how a program of mental therapeutics, on one hand, could help a person, under the right circumstances, rebuild a sense of self. But on the other hand, could turn into this hectoring and sometimes almost victim-blaming dogma or approach. And she left. And my message to the people in the positive thinking movement, and I say this to them as a person who's inside their world, not outside their world, is that if you can't retain smart, sensitive people like that, this movement is not going to maintain a congregational structure. You know, I think the positive thinking movement has got to get away from this one overarching idea, which is featured in The Secret, that our thoughts are this kind of super law that we all live under. We live under many factors and forces, and the caller was pointing out she was experiencing clinical depression. She needed medical care. She needed medical attention. The positive thinking movement has got to accommodate itself to the complexity of people's lives.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Lee. And let's move on to Monica joining us from Greenville. Hi there.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was not exposed to the positive thinking as a theology, so I couldn't say much about that. But I think it reminds me of my mother. We grew up Catholic, very devoted Catholic, but she has still a very positive way of looking at life. And she used to tell us when we were growing up, especially the girls, if you frown at your hair, you are for sure going to have a bad hair day. And her attitude was always one of, there are going to be problems in life. As I said, being a Catholic, we believe that God is in the driver's seat, but we still have the option of buckling up or not. And to take problems and be a part of the solution, not the problem. So your call reminds me of that. It's setting a lighter way of seeing it, not mm-hmm. as a theology or a religion.
So it sounds, Monica, like this is something you were okay growing up with, it because it taught you that you could maybe have some choice, some volition about the way you thought about the world.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Monica.
Yeah, I'm in great sympathy with what she said. You know, too often we hear these things and we think, oh, you know, don't tell me to have a nice day. It sounds so, you know, it sounds sometimes to people like it's immature or it's a sort of forced cheerfulness. But those ideas can go deeper and can represent more in a person's life than we sometimes understand. My mother-in-law is a devout Catholic, and she recently retired from a position as an associate dean at Harvard Medical School, a very accomplished person, and in many respects a very self-made person in the truest sense. She's absolutely dedicated to all kinds of positive thinking ideas and literature, and she has postcards and little business card-sized signs hanging up throughout her apartment that have all these positive thinking affirmations on them. And, you know, to the outsider, these things can sometimes seem like a forced display of cheerfulness. But for some people, they really do make a difference. They can flick a switch at certain sensitive moments that help an individual get through a stress or get through a difficulty of the day.
Mitch, looking toward the future, we've seen a lot of commentary over the years that we're getting more cynical. We're maybe more negative than we used to be. Do you see cynicism crowding out positive thinking in the United States?
I do, actually. The kind of discourse that goes on online and in texts and social postings, tweets and such, tends to be very, very coarse, and it's just endemic to our society. I think, actually, we are going through a really deep and substantial coarsening of our communication, and we as individuals are all going to have to take a look at that, because it's going to reach a point of irreversibility where rudeness and cynicism and sarcasm just becomes quite normal. And it's very different from the kind of correspondence that people conducted, say, 30, 40 years ago. One of the reasons, among many, that the positive thinking movement grew to popularity in the early 19th century is that the economy was changing from an agricultural to an industrial and corporate base. People were flowing into jobs in large offices and professional workplaces for the very first time. They didn't always know how to act, what proper decorum was, what proper communication was. To an extent, there are positive thinking books that people sometimes make fun of today, like Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, but those books answered a certain need. They helped people understand what was expected of them in terms of decorum in professional atmospheres. We are going to have to relearn those lessons in the digital age, because the degree, I believe, of cynicism and coarseness over digital communication is really becoming suffocating.
Mitch, thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
That was Mitch Horowitz, Vice President and Editor-in-Chief at Penguin's Tarcher imprint. He's the author of One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.